Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, you can check out everything else that 1517 is doing, which is a lot of things: academies, daily articles, videos, events. You can check all that stuff out. And while you're over there checking that stuff out, if you want to become a supporter, you can do that by supporting 1517. You, of course, support this podcast, or you can click a link in the show notes that says support this show. That's how all this stuff is possible. It's how all this stuff is free. So thank you so much to those of you who do that. Chad, we are continuing in Esther. Now, we didn't get very far because we did a lot of preamble last episode, so we're going to get into it this week. We haven't even met Esther yet. We got through the first 12 verses, and all we really got was, hey, Xerxes is a dude who will throw a very long party, and once you've been drinking for like 6 months, you might want to show your wife off. You know what? She wasn't real into that.
Yeah, she she gave him a big fat no. There was no, let me think about it. There's no maybe, perhaps tomorrow. It's just no. Which, of course, makes this section really funny, because as I think we pointed out in the last episode, here is this all-powerful ruler who's got this vast international kingdom, and yet his wife has her way. It's like, nope, sorry, not going to happen. By the way, I don't know if we pointed this out last time or not, but there's no reason given. I mean, we can speculate, of course. There's no reason given why she refused to come out when the king wanted her to kind of promenade before yeah, all his guests. But that hasn't stopped interpreters, even from ancient times, as to speculating as to, you know, what was going on. Maybe she just was tired of the king. But I was looking this morning on in Josephus's writings, and he says this: she, talking about Queen Vashti, she, out of regard to the laws of the Persians, which forbid the wives to be seen by strangers, did not go to the king. Isn't that fascinating? So it's one of the ways that Queen Vashti is kind of, she's elevated in these interpretations to be that much superior ethically than Xerxes is. I mean, which, of course, you don't have to be elevated that much higher to be higher than he is. But it's one more way in which Queen Vashti is kind of She's portrayed as kind of a paragon of virtue. She's she's subservient to the Persian laws, and then here's this king, you know, drunken, wanting to show her off. So she comes out looking even better than she did without any reason being stated.
It could be that. It could also be the thing that we just know about. I mean, I have a wife, you have a wife. I'm trying to imagine if I had like a really long party where I had like all my guy friends over, and I mean, it was going on for days, and then I wanted to like parade her out. I think she would say no to that. Not because of any sort of a law that she'd be breaking, but just out of, I'm not doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And rightly so. So the king's response to this is, of course, he's mad.
Yeah,
he's enraged.
He's enraged. His anger is burning within him.
Chad, yeah, in case you didn't know what enrage meant. He goes on to say his anger burned within him.
Yeah.
How dare, you know.
This is just a guy that's embarrassed.
That's all this is. Yeah, this is public shame. Public shame because, of course, you know, he was ready to show her off. And now, not only does she say no, but everybody's going to know that she says no.
Yeah, and I think it's been probably a minute since someone told him no.
Probably so. Probably so. Now, that all having happened, if he is publicly embarrassed, what follows in verses 13 and following makes this even more comical. Because okay, let's say, Dan, that you or I have been shamed. Okay, so we're mad, it hurts, all that now. Now, wouldn't it be ideal if the fewer the people who knew about this, wouldn't it be better? I mean, we don't want this spread abroad, right? It's not like we're going to make sure everybody knows about the shame that we've just experienced. So let's just keep it on the down low.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's not what happened. As we're about to hear, everybody in the kingdom is going to find out about this because they're going to pass this ridiculous law after the king consults with his wise men as to how they should respond to this.
It seems as though that these wise men, what they're really concerned about is, what if women start emulating the queen here in general?
Yes, right. And then they think that passing a law is going to take care of the situation. So here's what happens. The king said to the wise men, who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment. Now, in Hebrew, that's a nice kind of rhyme to those two words. In dot and deen, that's law and judgment. So in dot and deen, nice play on words there. So these guys who know dot and deen, he's going to consult them. And then we have a list of their names. And no surprise, there are seven of them. The royal mentioned seven princes of Persia and Media. Seven is a big number, not only just in the Bible, but we'll see seven crop up over and over in Esther as well. We've already seen seven eunuchs who served in the presence of the king. But anyway, he consults these guys. And these are the ones who were told saw the king's face and sat first in his kingdom. This is similar to the language we see elsewhere about, for instance, in reference to worship, you seek the face of God. That just means that you are given privileged status or gracious status in the case of worship to appear in the presence of a superior. That's generally what this means. The typical Hebrew expression for being in someone's presence is being in their face without any kind of negative connotations. That just means that you're right before them. Same way as when two people are talking, you're face to face, you're in each other's face. So if you're before someone, you are lifnei in Hebrew, that is to their face. So these guys who see the king's face are those who are right around him, his closest advisors, we might say, his cabinet, perhaps, to use a modern term. And here's what we read, verse 15. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti? Because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus, that is Xerxes, delivered by the eunuchs. So, you know, how are we going to deal with this situation? I mean, we're just going to forget about it. We're going to punish her in some way. We're going to pass a law. What should we do? Well, one of the guys by the name of Memucan, he stands up and he says, well, I have an idea. First of all, not only has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women. There's all of these alls in here. The queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought to him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath and plenty. So let's just kind of pause there. Now, this seems a bit overwrought, you know. Oh, yeah. Because the queen did it, pretty soon every single woman in the kingdom is going to be in rebellion against her husband.
This is it. This is part of the thing that's funny about Esther is that, like, in this part of it, like, there does seem to be this sort of this thing going on where these men are like terrified of like any sort of personal ownership of their lives that a woman might possibly take.
Yeah, I think the whole first chapter in many ways is written in such an extravagant and hyperbolic manner that it's supposed to be read almost as a comedy against the Persians, if that makes sense. It's like every single thing here is blown out of proportion, so much so that it becomes kind of funny. I mean, we can laugh at these guys, we can laugh at the king, we can laugh at all this kind of extravagance that's going on. And this, I mean, this is a pretty comical fear here too, because the one woman does this, all these guys are now afraid that their egos might be bruised. They might lose some control, that all this international revolt of the wives is going to erupt.
The international revolt of a wife telling her husband no.
Yeah. I can only imagine all of our listeners out there who are female are probably shaking their heads about right now at the idiocy of all of these guys who've got together this bro council, and they're going to come up with this plan. So anyway, that was the supposed fear. So what are they going to do about it? Well, verse 19 says, if it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes. We've before heard about the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Here you have it reversed. The laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti, notice it doesn't say Queen Vashti now. Every other time she's called Queen Vashti. Now she's just called by her first name. She's going to be unqueened, however that works. That Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. I'm sure she was sorely disappointed about that. Yeah. This is a kind of a backhanded blessing. Yeah, you don't get to see the king anymore. Oh, well, that's going to be rough to deal with. Yeah, man.
Really threatening her with a good time, aren't you?
So, first of all, she doesn't get to come again to King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. Okay. So when the decree was made, so the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast. All women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. I'm sure that as soon as this law is broadcast throughout the kingdom, all of the wives will just be falling all over themselves to give extra honor to their husbands as a result of this.
Hey, look, I know there's some people listening, and they're like, well, I mean, you know, wives are supposed to submit to their husbands and all this kind of stuff. And that's all fine. But I don't know how you read this without this making these men look extremely, like, afraid and weak.
Oh, well, yeah, they are. I think I really think that's the point. This is like, this whole thing is recorded to poke fun at them.
Yeah.
It's poking fun at Xerxes. It's poking fun at these guys. The only people, the only person who comes out looking good in everything we've covered so far is the queen.
Yeah.
Everybody else appears like a big fool.
You look ridiculous.
Yeah. All the men look like fools so far. So that's the end of the quotation, which began up in verse 13. So what'd they do? Well, verse 21 says that this advice pleased the king and his princes. And the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. That last little bit, speaking according to the language of his people, you can check the commentaries on that. There's a lot of different ways that that's interpreted. It's a bit strange. There are some people who make a slight imitation to the Hebrew to where it reads, say whatever suited him, which that makes sense. I think that the basic gist is obvious, that that every household, a guy is supposed to be the one in charge.
This is probably where you got the saying, man is king of his castle. So he's like, all right, guys, every one of you guys that's got a house, like, you got to look at it like you're me. And you're like your own little king in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that certainly is what seems to be implied here. So I did want to point one thing out here that's of historical interest. So they're going to send letters to all the royal provinces, you know, each in its own script, everybody in their own language. Now, this might seem to, you know, just on the surface, well, how are you going to do that? I mean, you got a vast kingdom here. Well, turns out that there was like a Persian Pony Express, basically. They had a... You can, if you check out the history written by Herodotus, the Greek historian, which I did this morning, he talks about how at one point Xerxes, he's talking about the same guy. Herodotus is writing about Xerxes, the same Xerxes that's being described here in the Book of Esther, how he wanted to get a message back to Persia. And Herodotus says that As many days as there are in that whole journey, so many are the men and the horses that stand along the road, each horse and man, at the interval of a day's journey. These are not stopped neither by snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor darkness. Sounds like the post office. From accomplishing their appointed course with all speed. So Herodotus describes this Persian Pony Express. So you got stations about a day apart, and the guy rides in, and he's able to change horses and then go on. So you can get messages spread rather rapidly through the Persian road system and through this this Pony Express that they use. So presumably then that is how the royal letters were spread throughout the kingdom.
That's a funny letter to get, too. I mean, imagine, like, hey, babe, just so you know, straight from the king.
Put that on the fridge.
What, you got to do what I say.
Yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of laughter happening all over the kingdom at the king's expense. So that's chapter one. We got Esther one under our belts, and that's setting the stage, really. I mean, it's all of this is sort of a preamble, a humorous preamble that's poking fun at the Persians as to what is about to transpire. This is kind of setting the stage because, of course, what do you need now? You got a queen, right? This is all preparing for the person that we are going to be meeting in chapter two, which, of course, is the one after whom our book is named, Esther.
And you can't just, like, you know, say who's up and who's next in line to be queen, you know, maybe some kind of a good political alliance, you know, this happens all the time, right? You got to go find somebody's got a daughter somewhere, and you know, it'd be good if you could, you know, unite the households, that kind of thing. No, we're going to have like a beauty pageant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. big beauty pageant. Yeah. So back to Herodotus, that Greek historian that I just quoted. He claims that the Persian king only received wives from certain royal Persian households, seven or eight Persian households. Maybe that was a standard, but judging by the Book of Esther, it was not limited just to those households. Yeah, and I'm also assuming, based upon a lot of evidence, that this is not going to be the only wife. I mean, we already were going to find out in chapter two, he's got a bunch of concubines. So it would not be surprising whatsoever, as if there were maybe they weren't all called queens, but you know, maybe they were the one that he preferred from his harem in this palace or in that palace. We know that there were, I think, three or four different big kind of capital cities of the Persian Empire. This is just one of them. So anyway, some time goes by, and we're gonna find out what happened to King Ahasuerus. So after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. You kind of get the idea that maybe he regrets his rash decision, possibly. Yeah, he remembers her, remembers what had happened, but he might be the all-powerful head of the Persian Empire, but he's also basically bound by his own laws.
Right.
So he's already passed the law. What are you going to do? He can't very well overturn that.
I mean, it's,
but he remembers.
It does sound like maybe there's a little bit of regret here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, number one, he was probably drunk. Mm-hmm. And many, many, many people have experienced regret over decisions made while they were intoxicated. Usually not the wisest decisions that people make when, number one, you're drunk, and number two, you're angry. Not a good time to make any kind of serious decisions. But anyway, he's cooled off. He remembers. So verse 2 says the king's young men who attended him came up with an idea. I notice it's the young guys who came up with this idea.
Yeah.
So here's what they said. King, we've got this. We got an idea. Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. And that the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Hegai, who is the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. So what do you think of that idea?
Well,
I mean, evidently he liked it. It says it pleased the king.
I was about to say, this idea sounded good to him.
Yeah, best idea he had heard in quite a while. So, I mean, this is going to be quite the undertaking. Number one, you got to find these beautiful young virgins, which are scattered throughout the empire. And then not only find them, but you get to bring them. And then they undergo, as we'll see, this long preparation period before they're actually brought into the king. I think this, too, is one more way of making fun of the extravagant hedonism, we might say, of the Persian king. I mean, this is we can kind of laugh about the ridiculous nature of this, but when you stop and you put yourself in a situation of not only the young women, but their parents, and not only the young women and the parents, but also any possible young men who wanted to make these women as their wives. I mean, the whole thing is a sad commentary on Xerxes and the way that he is going to basically exert his power to lead an ongoing life of hedonism. And this, from what we know from Herodotus, this is perfectly in conformity with what kind of king Xerxes was.
I mean, this is the sort of thing you can only do when you have the luxury of having like basically absolute power.
I mean, this is something only a tyrant could do.
Yeah. I mean, because you can't have like a bunch of like actual threats that you're worried about. And like, I mean, you must not have a lot of important things going on. If you're like you've basically conquered everything that there is to conquer, like you've got like excess upon excess, and this is the sort of thing that you only do if you've most rulers could not afford themselves something like they have actual things to do.
Yeah, this isn't something that you do when you have threats to your borders,
no,
or you have weighty matters of state to take care of, or anything like that. This is what happens when you have the decline of the empire. this is the kind of leadership that assures that your empire will be soon rotting to the very core.
Yeah,
because of course this is just a symptom of bigger issues. But anyway, that's the plan, and the king likes it, so he basically put it in place. Now back to that in a minute. We have to be introduced in verse 5 to the next two, not one, but next two major players in the story of Esther. Verse 5, now there was a Jew in Susa. Literally in Hebrew, there was a man of Judah there was. That's one of the ways Hebrew introduces a new character. So there was a man of Judah there was. There was a Jew in Susa, the citadel. And his name was Mordecai. Mordecai is actually a Persian name. It's pretty common. They found this in other records, of course, outside of Esther. So this rings true with the time period. Anyway, this guy named Mordecai. Listen to this. Give a little bit of his background. He's the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Now I'm going to just pause there for a second. So we've encountered Shimei and we've encountered Kish before, and of course we've encountered the Benjaminites before. The most famous member of this tribe, the one who is connected also with a Kish, the one who's also in that same tribe as Shimei, is our friend from way back in 1 Samuel, Saul. So he was from the tribe. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. Now the reason this gets interesting is because, remember, so if you're a longtime listener, you will recall this when we covered this back in 1 Samuel 15. Remember that everything was going great for Saul until he was sent out to destroy the Amalekites. And even though he did destroy some of them, he spared the king, and that king was King Agag, A-G-A-G. Okay, so that's 1 Samuel 15. Now, why am I pointing this out? So Saul, from the tribe of Benjamin, is connected to this King Agag, the one that he spared. And by sparing him, this was actually the beginning of the end for Saul, because that is when Samuel said that the kingship is going to be taken away from you and given to one better than you. Well, the reason this is important is because when we read a little bit further in the story of Esther, we're going to encounter the enemy, the chief antagonist in the story, whose name was Haman. And Esther 3 verse 1 says that Haman was an Agagite. A-G-A-G-I-T-E. So if you know the whole biblical story, you realize that now we're being introduced to a Mordecai from the tribe of Benjamin, which was Saul's tribe. And pretty soon we're going to be introduced to this guy named Haman, who, if you know the story of Esther, hates Mordecai. And Mordecai does not like him either. In fact, what starts the problems between them is that Mordecai will not bow down to Haman. But Haman is an Agagite, connected to that same group that King Saul had issues with way back in the day. So it all comes kind of full circle, except in this case. So in Saul's case, the king was his downfall. But in Mordecai's case, this is actually going to seem like Haman, the Agagite, is going to be his downfall, but actually ends up being that which promotes him to an even higher place. So it's kind of cool how all of the biblical history is kind of meshing together here with Esther and then what we cover back in 1 Samuel. But anyway, that's who this guy is. And then verse 6, we hear a little bit more about him. He had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives. Who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, the reason this little detail is important is because, so King Jeconiah was not the final king in Jerusalem when the Babylonians came in and destroyed the city. Instead, he was the king a little bit before then, back in 597, when you had one of the first deportations of the people of Judah to Babylon. That first deportation would have been people with money and authority. And the reason this is important, because this points to Mordecai's family, maybe his great-grandfather, whoever it was, points to the fact that Mordecai came from a family of some wealth or some, you know, social upward mobility, whatever it might have been. He's not just, in other words, just a common person. He probably has some power, he has some authority, or he had some wealth. At least he was part of those well-to-do families in Jerusalem who were among the first deportees to Babylon. So that's Mordecai. Comes from the tribe of Benjamin, a well-to-do family. But he's introduced in order that we might be introduced to the one that he has adopted and taken in and is caring for as a father figure, even though they are their cousins. Verse 7 says he was bringing up Hadassah, however you want to say her name. That is, and here we go, we're finally introduced to her, Esther. And she is the daughter of his uncle because she had neither father nor mother. So she's an orphan. And Esther was then taken in by Mordecai, and then he would have just raised her as her father figure. So here we are. We got Mordecai, and we've got Hadassah, also known as Esther. So she got two different names. Hadassah would be her Hebrew name. Esther would be her Persian name. And what does she look like? Well, we know, we've heard this many times before, that any time that in the narrative that physical characteristics of a person are described, then those physical characteristics are somehow going to work their way into the story. We've seen this over and over. These aren't just added for color, but they're always added because they're going to become part of the narrative that follows. And we are told in verse 7 that she had a beautiful figure and she was lovely to look at. So she had a pretty face. She had a nice looking body. In other words, she's got everything physically, appearance wise, she has everything going for her. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter.
This is a funny way to say that. If you know that an elaborate beauty pageant is coming up, of course the point of beauty pageants is to gawk at people, right? I mean, there's, you know, do beauty pageants, don't do
I thought it was all whatever. About the intelligence.
Yeah, it's whatever it is. Yeah, they basically just described her as like a perfect candidate for that. This person is great to look at. Like, well, that is sort of the criteria for the, for what's about to happen.
Right. Yeah, there's no escaping that. She's a candidate for Miss Universe, let's say, or at least Miss America, or whatever it might be. She's a pretty face, nice figure. And no doubt, of course, knowing just that is going to put her pretty high on the list of people who are vying for number one in this competition. So verse 8 says, when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women, we don't know how many, estimates are from 500 to 1400, when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, that's the king's chief eunuch. So when all this was happening, when they were gathering all these beautiful women from all over the empire, Esther also was taken into the king's palace. And she was put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. Okay, so we're introduced to another guy. So you got this eunuch who is going to be taking care of these women, you know, making all the logistical stuff that has to go on and where they're going to be and all those sorts of things. Now, Esther pleased him, that is, pleased this eunuch, and won his favor. Now, usually when we encounter a phrase like this in Hebrew, it is like it's more passive, like you receive favor or you find grace or you find favor in the eyes of someone. We've seen that a lot of different times, all the way back in the days of Noah. You know, Noah finds grace or he finds favor. A little bit different form is used here, which points to the fact that she is she's maybe more active here than most of those other passive statements. So doing things to win his favor.
Well, one, favor and finding favor are different.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to win, you got to compete. All right. So, like, she's competing for his favor, and she won.
Yeah. So right away, we not only know that she's obviously beautiful. I mean, that's, we're told that explicitly, but the fact that she wins his favor is indication that, well, she's smart. She's doing whatever's necessary in order to make sure that she gets on the very good side of this guy, who's obviously in a very authoritative position. So how did he respond? Well, he not just provided her, but quickly, see, he hastens to provide her with her cosmetics and her portion of food. And not only that, but 7 chosen young women from the king's palace. So she's not even queen yet. And she's got 7 chosen servants from the king's palace. And he advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Now, I don't know what that means, but the best place in the harem. I mean, the best room, who knows? But anyway, it's the best place in the harem to be. So things are, I mean, so far, things are looking pretty good for Esther under, of course, not the best of circumstances. We are not told anything about what she thought about this. I mean, was part of her excited? I guess maybe, maybe not. Was part of her scared? Probably. Is part of her even, you know, insulted? Possibly. We don't know. We're really not told anything about her emotions with regard to being placed in the situation in which she finds herself.
Yeah, you don't even get it from like Mordecai. Like you don't know initially how he feels about this. No idea. Is this like a great honor? I wouldn't think so. But or once you're thrust into this situation, are you like, well, I'm here. I got to play the game. So now I just got to do the best I can. Don't know. It's hard to get in someone's mind from that time period too. I mean, you're talking about a very long time ago.
Oh yeah, you're right. Right. I mean, that is something always to bear in mind. I mean, we might jump to conclusions and say, you know, how horrific this was. And
yeah, I mean, to us, you're like, this is horrific. Like, why you can't do this?
Yeah, well, keep in mind, and we were talking about this, I think, before we started recording. I mean, these girls, these are not like on The Bachelor.
Right.
This is not The Bachelor. So this is not the Persian equivalent of The Bachelor, where you have these gorgeous young women. Which I don't watch The Bachelor, by the way, but, you know. I know about it. So you have these gorgeous young women with these perfect bodies who are probably, what, I don't know, 20 to 30 years old. I don't really know how old they're, but we'll say mid-20s. All right. Now, these are no doubt much younger girls. So probably, I don't know, 14 to 18 years old, let's say. If they're not married, if they're if they're virgins, they're not married, then yeah, you're probably looking at early teens.
Yeah. Because people got married very young.
Yeah, much, much younger than people do today. Yeah, I mean, all of this rubs us the wrong way. But do keep in mind, different time, different place, and different perspectives. So she's at the best place in the harem. Now, verse 10, we find out that Mordecai had advised her. And this is going to be an important part of the story, because it's only she's going to keep something secret. And at a major turn in the story is when she's going to reveal this. So Esther had not made known to her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. So Mordecai's like, hey, let's not tell anybody that you're a Jew. That's what's going on here. So we're not told his motivation. No doubt it's because of the history between the Babylonians and the Jews, and then the fact that they were deported, and all whatever other things are kind of underneath the surface that we might not even be historically aware of. Mordecai thinks it's best if she not let it be known what her background is. So she didn't. And Mordecai is obviously, he's not her biological father, but he is her father and very concerned about her, because every day he's pacing. Every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. So he's obviously wanting to make sure that she's okay and everything is proceeding well for her. So verse 12 tells us we come to the day, right? The turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. So I think this is another more that kind of these kind of poking fun at the outlandishness of this entire proceeding. Really, 12 months to get them, to beautify them, to get them ready for this night with the king. So different, by the way, four different times in verses 12 through 14, you have this Hebrew expression to go into. Now that is probably meant as a double entendre, not only to go into in the sense of going to see the king, but also this is used both of men and women in a sexual sort of way, obviously with the guys, but it's also used in one context to refer to a woman. So probably two things are meant here. You go into the king. That means that you're not only going to appear before him, but you're also going to have sex with him. So they prepare for 12 months, each woman. And then verse 13, when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. So I assume that's, you know, whatever she wants to wear, whatever she wants to take with her to make sure that she appears as desirable to the king. So in the evening, she would go in and spend the night with the king. In the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of another guy, Ashkaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. So you pass from virginity now, pass from being a virgin to now you're a concubine, of course, because you have spent the night with the king. And then she would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So that's kind of the situation. I mean, you got all these women from all over the empire. They're spending 6 months with this, 6 months with that, 12 months getting all beautified in order that when their time came, that evening came, they would go to the king, they spend the night with him. The next day they would go out, they'd move to a different place because they're now a concubine, and I guess they wait and hope. I don't know if they hope or not, but they wait anyway to see if not only the king delighted in them that night, whether he was sexually pleased with them. That's really what this is talking about. And then he's got to remember their name. Some of that person, that woman back by name.
I mean, this is like the real bummer part of all this whole thing too. Cause like, it's not as though like, if he doesn't choose, it's not like you line them all up, he picks one and then the rest of them get to go home and, go get married to someone else and raise family. No, like you have all these women, and like you're just gonna end up in a harem of concubines. Like, that's a pretty big bummer.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about ruining a woman's life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of the situation in which we find ourselves. Now, we haven't, of course, gotten into Esther's night with the king, but that will be coming up next time. That'll be verses 15 and following. But that's kind of the whole situation that has led to what is going to transpire when Esther sees the king, and then what results from their night together.
All right. Well, we will be back next week to find out how that goes. Chad, I will see you then.
All right. See you then.